Big color, bigger savings. It's Sherwin-Williams' biggest super sale. Get 40% off paints and stains October 17th through the 27th with prices starting at $29.39. Whether you're refreshing your interior or exterior, we've got the colors to bring your vision to life. And with delivery, getting everything to your door is easier than ever. Shop online to have it delivered or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details. Delivery available on qualifying orders.
This is a special report from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast.
I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for joining us. Opening arguments today in the trial of Scott Peterson, the Parkland resource officer who is now facing accountability and charges for his failure to act in that horrible school shooting. This is now going to the defense, taking a listen to their opening arguments in the case today.
Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, we are here because my client was sacrificed. The evidence will show that he was thrown under the bus. My client is not a criminal, and the evidence will not prove that he committed any criminal offenses at all. He didn't know where those shots were coming from precisely. We've got 22 witnesses under subpoena who will come in here and tell you that they too heard the same shots my client did and could not discern precisely where the shots were coming from. There was a pronounced echo and reverberation that the witnesses will talk about that left them hearing the same shots and wondering, where is that coming from? He did everything that he possibly could with the limited information that he had to help serve and protect everybody at that school. He was sacrificed.
Judge, in your honor.
It's opening statement. Again, ladies and gentlemen, this purpose of opening statement is for the lawyers to tell you what they believe the evidence is going to show, but I'll remind you what the lawyers say is not evidence. Go ahead, sir.
Details matter. We want jurors who are extremely detailed, and I'm going to get into the weeds so you understand specifically what occurred. Numbers. Let's talk some numbers, because they don't lie, and that kind of sets the parameters of what happened. First number, 6:36. 6 minutes and 36 seconds. That's how long that monster, Nicholas Cruz, was in the 1200 building committing his atrocities. Nearly 6 minutes and 36 seconds. My client was there at the end of his rampage for 4 minutes and 15 seconds. I wanted to make sure you all had notepads. You can write down these details. They're critical. 4 minutes and 15 seconds. What is not in dispute at all is that when the shooter was on the first floor killing faculty and children, my client wasn't even on the scene yet, which is why he's not charged at all with those offenses. 17 and 17, more numbers that do not lie, that are uncontroverted. 17 children, 17 total people were killed as a result of this atrocity. 17 were injured. Of the 17 that were killed, 14 of them were children. I want you to take a look and understand why we're here. We're here because of this monster. This person chose to commit one of the worst mass shootings in our nation's history. He destroyed families. He destroyed lives. Everyone was affected by his terror. He is the one to blame for what happened that day. That is not in dispute. He chose to arm himself with an automatic, powerful weapon and kill innocent people. Those are actual screenshots of him doing what he did. Not if, but when you have very strong feelings in this case, whether it be because of the photos that they intentionally introduce, showing blood, gore, understand who's responsible for that. Not my client. More numbers. 32. 32 years my client dedicated himself to law enforcement and serving this community. 32 years, an unblemished record. You know, we have this image of cops as they age, as being in one of two categories. That idea that you've got some donut-eating, lazy cop who's got one foot in retirement, can't wait to get out the door. That was not my client. Every single witness we've spoken to, and who will testify, will tell you he was an exemplary officer. No ideas that he might be a coward in any way. He was great at what he did. A loving father of four children, two who served in the military, lovely wife. He went to work that day never thinking that some sick, twisted monster would do what he did. My client was one of those ones that Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, who would get in the middle of kids who were fighting. He would risk his life to protect others. If anybody needed any investigation done, he was there for them. Everybody will tell you, teachers, faculty, if they needed something done, he was the guy. He took care of them. He devoted his life to what he called his children. His children. He's broken up about what occurred. He was an award-winning deputy. In 2012, he won Parkland's Deputy of the Year.
What's the legal objection?
It's Armin, and it's also... it's. That was part of, I believe, our motion in limine in this case. The court ruled on it and previously.
No, it's overruled as to both. Again, what the attorneys think the evidence is going to show at trial. Go ahead, sir.
The evidence will show that he won in 2012 Parkland's Deputy of the Year. In 2015, he won Parkland's School Resource Officer of the Year. And then once again in 2016, he won Parkland's Deputy of the Year. This is within just 2 years of the February 2018 vicious attack on that school. This was an award-winning, decorated officer. He was an elite officer who did his job zealously and professionally and with courage. So what we have here is a man with a decorated history of serving the community for 32 years, and in literally 4 minutes and 15 seconds, they're claiming he became a criminal. That's what they're alleging. And understand what we're here for. We're not here to say, well, could he have done things differently if he had certain information? Administratively, should he have been, you know, reprimanded? Should we award money to people? That's not what we're here for. We're here for one purpose, because as we've learned, someone from their office filed a document, an information, a charging document, claiming 11 counts, and he has stood before this court, and he said, I am not guilty. And for 4 years, every time he came to court, he said, I am not guilty, because he's innocent. And he did not accept responsibility for crimes that he did not commit. Now, how did we get here? We'll talk about that. How does a decorated officer who did everything he could with the knowledge that he had, and we'll get into that, how does he sit as a defendant with his liberty at stake in criminal court. Details matter. So let's go back to February 14, 2018. That's when the massacre occurred. Now, whether it's right or wrong, the people at the top always get blamed. Sometimes it's justified, sometimes not. If it's raining outside, well, it's the president's fault. Gas prices go up, president's fault. But sometimes it's justified. What I will not do in this case at all is tell you whether Sheriff Scott Israel, who was the head of the Broward Sheriff's Office, whether it was justified that he was getting tons of criticism immediately after this. I will not get into that because I don't like the idea of anybody blaming someone without having all the facts. I won't do that. I won't be a party to that. You got one finger pointing out, you got three pointing back. But what I will say is that the governor did find that he was incompetent and he was removed from office. But before that ever happened, Sheriff Israel, who was on the hot seat, did a Jake Tapper CNN town hall meeting.
Special objection irrelevant?
Well, as to the relevancy objection, it's overruled. But Mr. Aguirre, let's stick to what you think the evidence is going to be in this case. Go ahead, sir.
If they don't call him, we will call Sheriff Israel to testify. We will. We have no burden in this case, but we will make sure that we call him to testify. And he will admit to you that he was under pressure. Naturally so. He's at the top. People started to question why certain deputies didn't go in, and we'll get to why they didn't. He wasn't the only one, by the way. There was at least six others that we will call to testify. We'll explain why they didn't go into the building either. They also thought the shots were coming from a different area based on the reverberation and based upon the echo. Good, meaningful, dedicated officers, some who initially lost their job but then fought and got it back, and they're working now. They have their jobs. My client's fighting for his liberty. But Sheriff Israel took that heat. I'm not saying it's justified, but he was under the gun. A lot of heat's coming his way. So he goes on CNN town hall meeting with Jake Tapper, televised for everybody to see. And he defends consistently. Before that, after that, he's defending his officers. They did the best they could with the information that they had, based upon the circumstances. He knew no one had done anything wrong. Well, that didn't fly. He will tell you that even after he went on to that Jake Tapper town hall meeting, yeah, people didn't like some of the things he said, including that he showed great leadership. And his officers didn't do anything wrong. You know, he took a lot of heat. So what does he do? Understand, he's the head of BSO. Thousands of deputies. But like any of us, we have supervisors. And if something looks wrong, you bring in somebody and you say, well, tell us what happened. You know, why didn't you go in? And you sit down and talk to him. You think that occurred? No, because that didn't fit his agenda. What you will learn, the evidence will show, is that Sheriff Scott Israel put Sheriff Scott Israel number one. Sheriff Scott Israel's ego is not his amigo. So what he did is he, the very next day, after he took the heat, after that CNN town hall meeting, and just so we're clear, this is who we're talking about. This is him at the CNN town hall meeting, defending everybody, no problem. But then he took the heat. And the very next day, this is him, at a very famous press conference that set into motion why he's sitting there.
Objection, Your Honor.
Again, it's overruled if that's what the lawyer believes the evidence is going to show. Again, ladies and gentlemen, I'll remind you, opening statements, this is not evidence. What the lawyers tell you is not evidence. It's what they believe the evidence is going to show. The objection's overruled. Go ahead, sir.
This press conference set into motion such unbelievable pressure. We'll talk about what happened. Let's talk about what he said and what he didn't say. He announces to the world, all the media there, this was the biggest case around. Biggest atrocity. People want to know what happened. And at that press conference, he said, regarding my client, well, he didn't go in to kill the killer. Now, what did that mean to all of us? I mean, anyone watching. Okay, wait a second. Someone from the police force. It's not very usual. What made it so credible is it's not usual to hear a police officer say something negative about another police officer. But even worse, what made his words so problematic is that it came from the top. A guy that people knew, a public figure, who spent his career trying to get everyone to perceive him as credible and believable and honest. And now he's throwing my client under the bus. He's saying he should have gone in to kill the killer. What did that mean to all of us? Number one, wait, I guess he must have known where the shooter was. Number two, my goodness, he must have known kids were being killed in that building, which he did not. He sat back and did nothing. He cowered it. Did nothing during that time period. Well, naturally, all of us, and I agree myself, said, my goodness, what kind of person does that? It was perfect. The media ran with it because now you had a villain. They had Cruz, but now you had a villain. Imagine a veteran officer with a naked scene, huddled down, and just did nothing and protected himself. That's not what happened. But that served Sheriff Israel's purpose. And here's what's more insulting and worse. Not only didn't he try to reach out to my client, the argument would be, well, there's thousands of deputies. Why would he reach out to my client? Because they were friends, ladies and gentlemen. Friends. Sheriff Israel worked as a football coach at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas while my client was there. Sheriff Israel's three sons all went to Marjorie Stoneman Douglas when my client was there. Sheriff Israel constantly spoke of my client, even asked him for help when one of his sons got stung with a bee at the school. He called Scott Peterson. When another son was hanging out with the wrong crowd, Scott Peterson was there to help. He had Scott Peterson's cell phone number. All he had to do if he cared about the truth was call him up and say, why did you go in? How rough was it? Tell us what happened. The evidence will show he didn't do it, and there's only one reason why. Because anything my client said, which would have explained why he didn't go in, would not have served Scott Israel. He didn't want to hear the other side. He needed a scapegoat. It's politics 101.
Objection, Your Honor.
Yeah, that's going to be sustained at this point. Mr. Agarsh, let's get on to the facts.
The evidence will show that Scott Israel said, I give you Scott Peterson.
Objection, Your Honor.
Yeah, that's sustained, Mr. Agarsh.
So what happened
there? Hold on, sir. Sir, we're not going to talk about the former sheriff anymore. Just because you believe the evidence is going to show at trial. Go ahead, sir.
Got it. So as a result of that press conference, everything goes out there. And then, it's no surprise, the governor gets involved.
Objection, Your Honor.
Yeah, that's sustained. Quick sidebar. Can y'all do the headset, please?
Wilson?
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
You'll hear that the man that we're talking about, Sheriff Israel, is someone who, when received, he got an email from one of the parents in this case. And the parent asked him, why didn't he go in? Why? He could have prevented my daughter's death. And Sheriff Israel responded, well, we're wondering ourselves. Can't teach courage, his whole thing. But what he failed to tell her was, your daughter was killed on the first floor. He wasn't even at the scene at that time. That's not even, you heard that from the state, that's not even a contradiction. My client was even on the scene, he was heading towards the scene. This is a man who cared so much about himself, the evidence will show, that to this day, I believe that there is a mother whose child was killed on the first floor who blames my client because Sheriff Israel never told her the truth. That is so disturbing. And I'm going to ask him about that. He needs to answer for that publicly. You're going to learn that an investigation began. And the lead investigator, Keith Whittick, who I'm going to have on the stand for quite some time, he's got a lot of explaining to do. It will not be quick, folks. just a little taste. I will ask him, you know, this issue, big issue in this case is what my client knew, right? Because he's saying he didn't know where the shots were coming from at certain times. Thought maybe the 1200 building, but maybe the 1300 building, maybe the 700 building. There were so many things going on that my client then says on his radio, while he believes the shooter is still in the building, Perry, referring to Deputy Perry, who was with someone who was injured. He just announced he was with someone who was injured. He said, Perry, does he know where the shooter is? Asking in real time, does that person know where the shooter is to try to find out where it is? And you will learn that Keith Riddick left it out of his report. And when asked, why? He said, well, the shooter was gone by then. I said, you mean by a minute and a half? No one on the scene knew the shooter had gone. He left through the west exit. My client didn't know. No one knew. Don't you think that goes to a state of mind? No, I don't. That's what you're dealing with. Or number two, he wrote, there's no evidence to support what my client said to investigators, that he ordered a code red. Yet Anna Ramos, we will call her, she will take the stand, she works for the school, she heard my client immediately ordered a code red for the benefit of all the kids, including the ones on the third floor that he is accused of neglecting. She came up to him and gave him a hug at one of the funerals to thank him for ordering the code red because it saved lives. Jeffrey Morford, assistant principal, he heard my client order the code red over the school radio. And then as a result, he said he ordered the code red. He only did it because he told me he heard Peterson do it. But Morford is credible and believable, yet Riddick, the lead investigator, fails to include that information in his report. This was a, you will learn, the evidence will show, a biased and failed investigation from the beginning, which ultimately led to charges like child neglect. We'll focus more on that throughout this case, but that somehow all of this leads to child neglect, charging him as if he's a mother who fails to give their child water or food, or a teacher.
Objection, argument.
Yeah, that's sustained. Go ahead, sir. The evidence will show.
The evidence will show that they charge him with child neglect, ladies and gentlemen. More on that throughout this case. Now, let's talk about the facts of what occurred and what really happened. And you've got paper and pen. Make sure that you understand exactly what occurred.
Let's do a general overview first. Prosecutor kind of went over it with you. I want to start big, and then we'll get down into the minutiae. I absolutely want to make sure at all times you understand this fully. If there's ever a time that I think I might need to go back and make it clear, forgive me. It's only because I want you guys to fully understand what's going on here, okay? So, first, this is a kind of an overview of the school. Now, while this board is small, it in no way represents the 45 acres that the school is. I need you all to understand that because, unfortunately, we're not going to get to go to the school together. We're not. So I'm going to have to do the best I can to recreate it. And like going to Paris and seeing the Eiffel Tower or Egypt and the pyramids, there is no way to properly recreate it. There's not. We're at a loss. So I'm going to do my best.
Objection, Your Honor.
Yeah, that's a stain. Another quick sidebar, please.
Kind of a representation of the school. We'll use this to get a perspective. This is building number one. Let's start there. Building number one is where my client's office is, where it was anyway, Scott's office was, and where he was while he got information that there was firecracker complaint inside the 1200 building, okay? So understand, he's here, let me say general, okay? This is the 1200 building where it occurred. This is literally like a football field. I mean, this is far. Then you have next to it the 1300 building, and then you'll hear reference in my opening and throughout this case, the football field. This is over here. This is literally hundreds of yards away. Hundreds of yards from the 1200 building. So when you hear, for example, Deputy Kratz, who will testify that He went on his radio during the shooting, while the shooter was actually on the third floor, and yells, "Shots fired by the football field! Football field!" And my client's trying to figure out in real time where the shots are coming from. Deputy Kratz is referring to over here, hundreds of yards away, not where the actual shots were coming from. Kratz will tell you with his own words, he literally thought the shooter was 30 feet away from him on the football field. So this is the overview. Okay, I'll refer to it if needed, but just so you have a perspective. So my client is here, building number one. So he's in, we can take Sheriff's right down. Let's see. Is there a way just to take that off for 1 second? We'll be putting it back up. Thank you, Judge. So my client was in his office before the shooting took place. And what he was doing is he was investigating a felony. One of the students, an 18-year-old, had a fake driver's license. And what he was doing was he was researching at the time the statute, the felony statute, so he could tell the father who was coming to the school and the daughter. He wasn't going to arrest her or anything, but they wanted to know. It's a very serious offense to possess a counterfeit driver's license. So he was busy researching that. His phone was across the room being charged. But he did overhear at one point, firecrackers in the 1200 building. Firecrackers. Now, it was Valentine's Day. There had been fireworks, you know, let off in the building before. It wasn't like, oh my goodness, at that point. So he and Kelvin Greenleaf begin to leave. When they start to run is when all of a sudden the fire alarm goes off. You'll see on the video, they start to head towards there, and all of a sudden, fire alarm. And then they start to run. Now let me just stop. The evidence will not show that then he goes, wait a second, those firecrackers or fireworks could be gunfire. Let me go jump into my car and drive away. You will learn that that never happened. See, that we could all agree would be neglectful. But he immediately runs, and then he gets picked up by Andrew Medina, who's driving a golf cart. And the evidence will show you that at no point on their way to the 1200 building does Andrew Medina share with my client some really helpful material. Like he saw someone, that nutty cruise guy, walking with a duffel bag or some type of large bag that potentially contains some serious items in there, and that he walked into the 1200 building. He never shared that with my client. That would have been real helpful. To this day, you'll hear Kelvin Greenleaf testify that he's still angered to this day that Medina never shared that information with any of them. That would have completely changed this. My client would have known. Wait.
Objection argument.
Yeah, that's sustained, Mr. Agarwal. At this point, I'm going to have to remind you, as I've done repeatedly, yes. This isn't closing argument. This is your opening statement, okay. So let's stick to what you believe the evidence is going to show. Go ahead, sir.
The evidence will show, because we will call Kelvin Greenleaf if they don't, that he never heard Medina at all share with them the information that he had, which could have led to a different trajectory. So now, when he gets to the scene, and you all take a look at this, and it's going to be a little overwhelming at first. I promise I'm going to break it down for you, okay? But it's critical that you understand where the shots were coming from, okay? All right, let's stay general on this at first, okay? First, this is the same, we got the same thing that the prosecutor put up in his opening. But there's more detail, so it would be accurate. First, understand this represents the first floor. Even though these two are together, it's kind of overlapping. The second floor overlaps to show that it's over the first floor. But this is the first floor, right here. And second floor is here. And then third floor is here. Everybody with me so far, okay? We've got north, west, east, south, so you can see that, okay? And don't look at the shots just yet. Okay? That's something we'll get into in just a moment. Let's start general. As I indicated to you...
Mr. Agarwal, I'm sorry. If you need your support staff to help you move this stuff around, I'm going to ask you to step out of the jury box, please. So you need to be out here in the well of the courtroom.
Okay.
If you want to do the signs one at a time, that's fine. But
that's fair.
I can't have you in the jury box. Thank you, sir. Thank you.
I'll stand over here. Everyone can still see? Okay. This is worth repeating. Again, big picture. 6 minutes and 36 seconds, total time he's spending. We're going to show you exactly how we account for that time, okay? And this is not in dispute. I don't think that anyone's going to dispute these times. We made sure that they're actually from the material we received from the state, okay? Deputy Peterson was there for the last 4 minutes and 15 seconds. And the final 2 minutes of the 4 minutes and 15 seconds, I'm jumping ahead, were spent with the shooter on the third floor shooting west, the furthest possible distance from where my client was. So let's stay general again. What we didn't learn just yet, and you're about to learn, is this building, the 1200 building, is 73 yards long. The evidence will show that we're talking about 3/4 of a football field. And so that you guys have an idea of what that looks like, I'd like to show you, so you have a perspective of what the building looks like. Judge, if you turn that on. This picture doesn't even have the entire building in it. It was the best one that we got. So what I want you to take a look at is this. Let me hit play for a second. This is, here we go. Yeah, this plan. Okay, from one end all the way to the other end. Take a look. As you can see, this is a huge, huge building. It is nothing like I'm sure you imagine. To give you further perspective, this is to show you just the size and the distance of what we're talking about. What you're seeing now is the last 2 minutes. As I told you, the shooter was in the 1240 building, sniper firing out of two windows. What I'm showing this to you right now is just to see the perspective from where that shooter is to where the 700 building is and where my client was located. Try to give you some perspective. I'll pause it at one point. And by the way, what you're looking at is a recreation done by the state of what the shooter was doing. Okay. Technology. Give me a moment, folks. I'm just going to let it run. I will not stop it, but I'll talk over. This is the west side of the building. This is the side that Aaron Price was shot on, and where my client He was on the other side of this building, 73 yards away. Here's the door that you see right there where Aaron Price was shot outside of. And then all the way in the distance, on the other side is where my client was, and to the right is the 700 building. And that becomes key because a lot of kids come out of that building, hear the same shots my client did, and thought that those shots were coming from a different location. Okay, so let's continue. The first shots that my client hears, and you'll be able to see it on the video, everything is corroborated by the video. The first shots occur here, 2:23:25. 2:23:25. This is, as you can see, the shooter is pointing his gun west, in a westerly direction. My client, by the way, is approaching the east side door, about to go in to check out a firecracker complaint. Not an active shooter. He was not there during the time that the shooter had made his way through the first floor and killed people. No one went on the radio. You'll be able to see the entire dispatch. No one said, shots fired in the first floor, kids being killed. Nothing. He didn't get any of that. You'll be able to see. You'll read it yourself. He gets there, and both him and you'll hear from Greenleaf, they believe they're investigating the firecracker complaint. Because the door was open, shots get fired. My client hears a loud boom. He doesn't think, wait, kids are being killed in the 1200 building. He just hears a loud boom. The first thing he does as he's approaching the door, and he never opened up the door, if he ever looked in the window or got close enough to do it, he probably would have seen the carnage that was created by Cruz. But he didn't get that chance. He walks close to the door. He hears those shots. The Las Vegas shooting, you will learn, just occurred months before. So sniper fire is one of the possibilities. You hear shots from outside. He feels vulnerable, you will learn, the evidence will show. But the first thing he does is he doesn't run for cover. He stands there out in the open and immediately does what a cop does. You report shots fired. Here are his dispatch remarks. And the first one he makes at 2:23:26, note that it was 1 second, 1 second after Aaron Feist's shot from outside, my client immediately gets on his police radio and he says, be advised, we have possible, could be firecrackers. So let's start there. 4 minutes and 15 seconds, the evidence will show, starts to tick when he gets on the scene. He's only got 4 minutes and 15 seconds to get to the shooter and neutralize the threat. But what you're going to learn is he's still struggling with, firecrackers? And then he says, I think we have shots fired, possible shots fired. And 1200 building is a reference because he's standing 10 feet from the 1200 building. You will see a couple of references to the 1200 building, and the evidence will show that that is his positioning at the time. Not, I'm hearing shots fired with certainty from inside the 1200 building. He never says that. The closest he gets, as you will see, is by inside. He's struggling. When he hears more shots, you will see, the evidence will show, that one of the options is it's by the 1200 building, because the building's 73 yards long, and that contains a large area, and also possibly inside sniper firing, which is exactly what it turned out to be. All that's in play. You will learn that we know so much now about what actually happened.
Objection, argument.
Yeah, that's sustained, sir.
The evidence will show that neither he nor the officers in real time had all the information that we have today. That's just a fact. So everything in his mind is at play. Everything, you will learn, is a possibility at that moment. Now, this is telling, because right after this, again, we're talking about 20-some-odd seconds later, my client is saying, make sure we get some units over here. I need to shut down Stoneman Douglas. This is the first of five transmissions where my client's making it clear, we need to shut down this school. He doesn't say, we need to get into the 1200 building because kids are being killed. He says we need to shut down the school because the evidence will show that he and the other officers will testify to it. They all believed that the gunfire could be coming from anywhere
And that if, as school is letting out, parents come in, students are coming out, they could all be hit by gunfire around the building, anywhere on campus. Not, the evidence will show, not that everything was contained within the 1200 building and someone needs to rush in there. That's what the evidence will show. So my client, you will learn, went with Kelvin Keating. He doesn't stand in the open. But right before he does, not only does he make this first transmission to send the cavalry, you'll hear many officers saying that my client was a great service to them because they didn't know about the shooting until he announced it. I mean, he set in motion the wave of all the officers coming to the scene. He did his job. You will learn then that he also gets on a school radio before, again, going to this tactical position of cover. Before he does that, he gets on a school radio and he announces, code red, for the benefit of everybody on that campus. Then he doesn't stand out in the open, you will learn. He goes and he makes sure that he and Kelvin Greenleaf are protected over here. Because there's, you will learn that both of them, Kelvin Greenleaf will say, listen, you don't stand out in the open. In fact, my client even said at one point to Kelvin and others, get away, get away, get out of the way. I want to highlight just some of the other things that my client said in real time. And I also want to, we'll go into greater detail during the trial, okay, about what each of the shots meant and what he was thinking throughout this. But ultimately, you will learn that there was literally 34 seconds from these shots to here for my client to have gotten up and then somehow neutralized or killed the killer. You will learn that it took a SWAT team of 12 people 30 minutes to clear the first floor, second floor, because you don't just go running into the third floor and kill the killer. The evidence will show that the SWAT team had to first go through every classroom. It took them 30 minutes to clear the first floor, second floor, third floor. The evidence will show that even if my client knew, which he didn't, where precisely the shots were coming from at 4 minutes and 15 seconds when that started, there is no way he would have made a difference. No way.
Objection argument.
Yeah, that's the stain.
The evidence will also show that you'll hear from the officers who are over here, west of the building, that even when the shooter was in the middle of the third floor, that these officers thought that the shots were coming from a different location, outside, not inside. Just a few more transmissions I want to go through. And again, we have the whole trial to be together to go through everything. I want to bring it all out in my opening. We'll get to it. Okay, I'm anxious for you to hear the evidence. Okay, my client is saying, we don't have a description yet. We just hear shots fired. It appears to be shots fired. Again, you see him trying to lock down the school. Get the school locked down, gentlemen. Get it locked down. What that's doing, the evidence will show, is it's keeping officers and people away. Now, did that turn out to be, in retrospect, the evidence will show, the wrong decision?
Objection argument.
Yeah, that's a stain. Ladies and gentlemen, the purpose of these opening statements is just to give you a preview of what the lawyers believe the evidence will be. Mr. Agarsh, I'm going to admonish you at this point. Please refrain from any further argument. Continue and or conclude your opening statement, please. Thank you.
You will hear officers testify that in what by shutting down the school, officers didn't get in. And in retrospect, they will tell you.
Objection argument.
Yeah, that's sustained. Okay. That's sustained. Go ahead, sir.
Great. So, again, at 2:25:56, this is all during while the shooter is shooting. My client's saying, we're locking down the school. We're locking it down. He's reporting, I hear shots fired. So this allegation that he doesn't then include that he heard extra shots, it's right there. He's telling you, shots fired. And this is key. This is why I put it in red. My client said 2:28. So we're talking about literally 25 seconds after the shooter was done shooting. But understand something. The evidence will show. My client didn't know, nor did any of the officers know, that the shooter was gone. He slipped out, you will learn, through the west side door, the opposite side that he came in, and blended in and got away. So all the officers are thinking for quite some time that the shooter or shooters, and by the way, no one knew it was just one. You'll hear from the officers saying, there's the plus one rule. that if you think there's one, think that there may be two. If you think that there's three, there may be four. So understand that the evidence will show now we know there's one twisted monster. But at the time, they're thinking there may be multiple. That's what the evidence will show. But here's what my client says. Do not approach the 12 or 1300 building. Stay at least 500 feet away at this point. You will get to decide why my client is including the 1300 building instead of just saying 1200 building. He's also saying, Perry, does he know where the shooter is? Asking in real time. Does he know where the shooter is? You will learn that the lead investigator, he will tell you that he left that out of his report because he didn't think that was relevant. Lockdown, right now, nobody's leaving the school, my client says. And still, look at this time, 2:45:25. The shooter's been gone for 18 minutes. And my client is telling everybody, between the 12 and 1300 building is the last time we heard shots. Between the 12 and 1300 building. That's what all the officers heard. That's what they believed. Now, I know you're wondering, didn't he get any information on his radio? Right? You'll learn that kids had cell phones. You will learn that they did call in that there is a shooter, and that shooter's located in the 1200 building. But you will learn that those calls went to Carl Springs Police Department, not Broward Sheriff's Office. You will learn that nobody conveyed the information that went to Carl Springs Police Department with the Broward Sheriff's Office. You will learn that nobody ordered that the radios be patched so that two agencies who are supposed to be working together could know all the same information. You will learn that Carl Springs police officers knew certain information because those calls came in to Carl Springs, but that the Broward Sheriff's Office officers, like my client, you will see what they learned, and at no time did they ever inform him that there were shots fired inside the 1200 building and that children were being harmed. Even Sheriff Israel will come and tell you that that was a colossal failure that hindered my client. He will also admit to you that the radios that they were using failed miserably. Meaning officers, you will learn, will come in here and say that they were trying to communicate with fellow officers and that the radios were throttling. So when they would try to make any type of announcement or hear things, one officer will testify, it was like having a brick in your hand. Yeah, they have good training, you'll learn, but they never have training where their radios don't work. You will learn that officers will say, yeah, they have training, but they never have training where you have no idea where the shooter's located, just a general area. I have to mention Denise Reed, because the state still, they read her name as somebody they might call. And if they do, I will tell you, this is an assistant principal who may testify, and she may tell you that during the shooting, allegedly, she got within 15 feet of my client and allegedly claimed, hey, there's shooting going on, whatever she's going to say. I don't know exactly what version she's going to give to you. But something like indicating that my client must have known then that shots were coming. Ladies and gentlemen, the evidence will show that there is a video showing her movement down the hallway. And you will see for your own eyes that in spite of her giving that sworn testimony, that she had this contact with my client, she literally is walking without breaking stride and then goes into the band room and stays in there during the whole shooting. You can clearly see with your own eyes she never, ever had any contact with my client in spite of what she may allege if the state calls her. Ladies and gentlemen, as I conclude,
I want to briefly touch on the perjury count just for a moment. Detective Curcio will testify that when my client came in for this interview, it was 2 days after the shooting. He wasn't under investigation at all. That didn't come until a year later with charges brought. So he comes in, and Detective Curcio was the detective in the Nicholas Cruz homicide case. So my client, being a witness, has to be investigated. My client wasn't on the hot seat at the time. My client had no reason to think that he was going to be in trouble at all. The evidence will show that there were just questions asked. So what happened? What did you see? What happened? And specifically, Detective Curcio will tell you that he asked this in a chronological order. Like, okay, so when you got to the scene, you get to that building, how many shots do you hear? My client said 2 to 3, because it's exactly how many he heard. And we know that because the first shots he hears is Aaron Weiss being shot, and he was shot 2 to 3 times. That's the perjury count. Detective Curcio will tell you that he never then asks my client, how many total shots did you hear from beginning to end? He will tell you, yeah, I didn't think that question was necessary. That's the perjury count. The second part of the perjury count is they claim that my client saw some kids leave the 1200 building. While my client's on his radios, while he's telling kids in the 700 building, stay back, while he's doing about a million things with the stress of the world on his shoulders.
Objection, argument.
Yeah, that's sustained.
The evidence will show that they're claiming my client didn't see kids running out of the 1200 building.
I'm quite certain you will not see any video of those kids actually leaving. I would imagine if they're representing it that kids did leave the 1200 building. He told Detective Curcio he didn't see kids leaving the 1200 building. There will be no evidence that those kids ever came up to my client or had blood on them or something to indicate that they need to be spoken to or investigated. The evidence will show he didn't lie about that at all. Another charge for which he did not commit.
Objection, argument.
Yeah, that's a stake, Mr. Aguilar. Because of your continued objectionable comments, I'm going to ask you to conclude your opening statement at this time. Go ahead, sir.
I'm concluding, ladies and gentlemen. The evidence will show that my client did not commit any of the offenses alleged. He was sacrificed and thrown under the bus.
Objection, argument.
And if that is sustained.
And the only verdict in this case, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your kind attention. The only verdict that speaks the truth in this case, based upon the evidence, is not guilty. Thank you.
That wraps up the opening arguments in the trial of Scott Peterson. We'll, of course, have courtroom audio for you every single day here as this trial progresses. That was the defense wrapping up their portion of the opening arguments. I'm Tony Bruschi. Stay with us.
This has been a special report from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Mr. Monopoly here. Monopoly is back at McDonald's. Register in the McDonald's app so you're ready to...
get your bag!
Two ways to peel for a chance to...
get your bag!
Physical peels with select items and digital peels with others to...
get your bag!
Play Monopoly at McDonald's.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba. No purchase necessary. See rules at playatmcd.com for full details and amoe.playatmcd.com to play without purchase. Ends November 23rd, but bonus play ends November 2nd. Monopoly is a registered trademark of Hasbro. Copyright McDonald's.